This is O Ship, the show where experts and leaders look back at their biggest moments of failure just so you can avoid making them. And there is no one better to squeeze the naked truth out of our charismatic guests than your host, Chameleon Collective founding partner, Freddie Laker.
In today's episode of O Ship Show, we're venturing into the heart of what it means to be rich, not with money, but with experiences. How do you measure true wealth? Is it possible to become a billionaire in life's most valuable currency? Well, our guest, Joe, has navigated the tumultuous waters of entrepreneurship to emerge not just as a successful business founder, but as an architect of living life to the fullest. With a legacy of impactful ventures like Ramp Logistics, This Shirt Helps, or LSTN Sound, Joe's journey transcends the conventional metrics of success. But as the co-author of Experiential Billionaire and a pioneer in celebrating life's every moment, he's here to share the art, science, and path to enriching your life with unforgettable experiences. So join us today as we uncover the secret to becoming an experiential billionaire and living life beyond regrets. Ready to redefine your wealth? Well, let's dive in. Yo, welcome to our ship. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me, Freddie.
I'm looking forward to chatting with you. I know you just got back from a crazy, cool trip, journeying through some different parts of the world. I'd love to dig into that a little bit later today. You're a very different guest to some of the folks I've had on the show. We've had authors, we've had people that are kind of diehard entrepreneurs. Obviously, you're in a bit of both, but what makes you so fascinating and so inspiring is the way that you've kind of looked at reapproaching your entire life, frankly. But before we get to that, I would love to just kind of help our audience, who does include a lot of entrepreneurs and business leaders and folks like that, to kind of understand, like, how does your entrepreneurial journey lead you to this place where you're kind of advocating for a life full of experience?
Sure. That's a great question. And there's a lot of experiences on everyone's entrepreneurial journey. So I think people, they come to discover things at different points in life that a lot of folks, I think, don't get to discover until a bit later. My particular journey, though, even my entrepreneurial journey itself started off from something that happened to me when I was pretty young. When I was 18 years old, first of all, I'll just start off with, you know, I had a pretty rough adolescence. I made a lot of poor yet probably typical choices for a lot of folks. I wound up getting kicked out of high school, and I managed to get back into high school, and I barely graduated. But right around that time that I graduated high school, my father had a very sudden episode, a near-death experience. We wound up rushing him to the hospital for what we thought was a heart attack. It turned out his heart was failing. He needed a heart transplant. And there was this few month period where we were just touch and go. And he did get a transplant. It was a, you know, lucky situation. And there was a happy ending there. But it was just a really enlightening moment for me, because he came out of the other side of the transplant and he had to change his whole life, because there was just all these things that he wanted to do that he had been putting off forever, that now with this near-death experience, he became, like, you know, aware that there's no guarantee that this future that he was planning for even exists. So for me to see that at 18, it was just this crazy, you know, wake-up call. Because when you're young, you know, you don't really, you're not thinking about those things, and you think you're going to live forever and you've got plenty of time. So all of a sudden, I just was given this crazy gift of urgency to try to figure out how to do all the things I wanted to do with my life. And that started off, you know, it just created a chain reaction where, you know, I wrote a list of things literally that I wanted to do someday, and then started figuring out how to, like, actually do them. And it was like a, you know, very, very immature 18-year-old list, you know, like some things I'm sure people will relate to. Like, I wanted to go skydiving, and I wanted to start a t-shirt company, because one of the few classes I actually managed to pass in high school was screen printing. So I literally wound up doing that. I wound up, like, moving away from all my friends I grew up with because they were not the best influences. And I moved to the beach and met some other friends and started a t-shirt company that failed miserably immediately. But it was like these things they created momentum, and they taught me that I could actually take control of my life. And that was really powerful. And, you know, I'll kind of, like, skip through a bit further, but, you know, I spent a few years, quite a few years, actually, probably more than half a decade or so, working the kind of jobs that I think a lot of people find themselves in when they don't have an education or a lot of clear direction. I was waiting tables and bartending and stuff like that. But I was filling every other moment I could with life experiences after seeing what happened with my dad. You know, I was like really, really active about chasing goals and dreams, but they weren't financial goals. I still did want to be rich, you know, though. Don't get it wrong. I was very interested in, like, you know, mansions and Ferraris kind of rich. But as time went on and I started doing more things, I wasn't getting any richer, but I was feeling very, you know, fulfilled. I was feeling like I was living a pretty good life. I was mostly happy. And then though what happened was I started to realize I had more and more friends. And these friends were all people that I met through all of these life experiences. And the more of those friends I had that were closer, the more opportunities I was starting to get to actually do things that could check both boxes. And that's how I wound up actually starting my second t-shirt company, which was I had helped a friend get through a hard time. And I took him skateboarding with me a bunch to get him back in shape after a health scare. And he wound up calling me one day and said, "Hey, do you want to start another t-shirt company?" Clearly, he didn't see the memo about how the first one failed. But yeah.
Lucky you.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. So we started, you know, the second one. I told him, I said, "I don't have any business experience." And I'll never forget, he actually said, "You know, I think you'll figure it out because you always seem to figure out how to get things done. You know, you're always doing new and interesting stuff." And, you know, he saw the value of my life experience, not my business experience, which I thought was interesting. So we started off this new t-shirt company, and, you know, calling it like a business is kind of a glorification because it was like a two-person operation in a small garage. You know, the crazy thing is we started it and it was very much the similar situation as the first one I started, you know, which was that we made a bunch of t-shirts that we loved. I gave away way more t-shirts than we sold, and the company started failing immediately, which we should have saw coming. But this time around, we did figure out how to turn that company, that failing t-shirt business, into a successful shipping and warehousing company with over 100 employees. So we built this business, and this entrepreneurial journey part, you know, the answer to your question, this was like the second really remarkable, you know, part of life, I think, for me, which was right around that time that we hit that milestone of 100 employees. I looked up and 10 years of my life had gone by since we started that company. And somewhere along the way, I had lost that urgency and I had stopped doing all those things that were fulfilling. Not only was I not chasing new goals and dreams, I wasn't doing the things I already knew that I loved, the stuff that I figured out in the first, you know, chapter of my life that I enjoyed and that gave me, you know, joy in general. And yeah, that was like a moment where I looked up and thought, I'm financially stable and successful for the first time ever. And my life felt bankrupt. I felt like I was failing at life. And that made me change everything. And that coincided, coincidentally, with my dad, actually, his bonus round, as he liked to call it. And my dad, by the way, when he got the transplant and changed everything, he moved to a beach town in Mexico. And he did all this amazing stuff that he had always wanted to do. Like he went sailing and learned how to like kayak and mountain bike and all this stuff that, you know, we probably tell ourselves we're going to do one day that we just never get around to. And, you know, I got to see that whole second chapter. And then for me, when that moment happened at the 100 employee mark, that was right when my dad actually got sick for the second time. He did pass away. And when that happened, it just kind of shook me again. And I was like, oh yeah.
I feel like you learned a lesson when you were younger. And then it was like, maybe you forgot, you know, time goes by, you get caught up in work. It's funny how the universe does that, you know, to you.
Yeah. And there was a spiraling event, like really, right around that time, my wife and I, well, I was working so much, I was neglecting, you know, all of the things I loved doing. I was neglecting my mental health, my physical health, my relationships, which was ironic because that's how I built the business and that's how I had the opportunity for the business. As a result, you know, right around that time, my dad passed, my wife and I divorced, my dog died suddenly. It was like this terrible country western song that just kind of unfolded.
The universe was rubbing salt in the wound on that one, I think.
Yeah, it really kind of all came crashing down. But as that happened, you know, it just brought back to focus, like, what matters? What do I care about? What's my life really about? And that kicked off a whole nother chain of events.
One of the things I thought was so interesting is, you know, that's the foundation that kind of put you on this new path. Yeah. So, you know, one of the things I thought was so interesting about your background is when I was looking at your career after that company, your next two companies, you were listed as a director of positivity, which I think is so interesting. And you know, that I think is a kind of reflection of maybe where the mindset where you were at this point with all these lessons you'd taken. And these companies also had kind of an altruistic slant on them in terms of how they gave back to society. So I'd love to understand how basically, you know, this pivot point in your life, how you manifested that in these next two businesses.
Sure. And, you know, there's like this umbrella over a lot of the stuff that I talk about, both in the book, in our talks, and that really shaped my life, that a lot of things are contemplating death. I always have to tell people, though, it's not about death. It's about life, right? It's about, you know, understanding that this is our one and only precious life. So, you know, again, there was this moment where with my dad, especially, you know, again, my dad was on permanent disability after his heart transplant, yet he started a charity. He was literally making $716 a month. And when he got to Mexico, him and a friend basically started a charity with $100 that, you know, they knew that $100 by itself wasn't going to do anything, but they knew that doing nothing wasn't going to do anything. So they tried. And that kicked off a chain reaction where a bunch of other people saw them do that. And then they said, how can we help? And they got involved. And then together that grew into an organization that by the time my dad passed away had helped hundreds of children get all the way through university. These were underprivileged children that were literally like living in like landfills. And, you know, at the end of his life, that was one of the things he talked about the most and was most proud of. And it was just so clear that, you know, I just kept thinking, like, what am I going to think about toward the end of my life? What mattered that I did? And I think that, you know, we're not going to care about all the busy work, right? We're not going to care about all the things that we did that were just kind of like checking boxes and to-do lists and whatnot. We're going to care about the lives that we changed and helped. And once that became clear to me, that became like my, you know, that was my North Star. It's like, I want to do something with whatever I do. I wanted to have the goal of helping people. And even if it helps like one person, you know, that was a mission that was worth it, right? So that really influenced, you know, my whole altruistic adventure. And I'll say that, you know, I've been inspired by lots of other people and lots of other companies. And it's been so rewarding to see people reach out to us and say that they started something and are doing something because of something they saw us do. So it's very much a ripple effect.
I love that your family has, you know, been such a big inspiration to you. I definitely identify on a lot of the different things that you've actually mentioned today. Just actually, strangely enough, had some similar things that have certainly impacted my life. I'd love to jump forward a little bit. So can you explain the concept of being an experiential billionaire?
Sure. Yeah. It's about being super, super rich financially. No, I'm kidding. Yeah. So it's funny. The easiest way, the easiest way I would describe it is it's not about checking boxes. Again, it's not about like you got to this level of accomplishment or, you know, you put in a bunch of goals on a list and you checked them off. It's actually more about knowing that you've done the work to figure out what matters to you in your life and that you're trying to do those things. You're taking action and taking steps toward that. Because to me, I think that's really the key to avoiding regret. And that's, you know, that's how we know that our life is on track or that we're, you know, in the right space. Because if you get to the end of your life, you're going to face this harsh truth, whether you like it or not, like whether or not you left a bunch of potential on the table, you know, whether you actually did the things that you said you wanted to do or that in your heart you knew you wanted to do. So to me, really, that's what an experiential billionaire is. I can tell you the backstory for where we came up with the term, if you'd like to hear that. You know, my business partner, Bridget Hilton, and I started the first ever social enterprise audio brand called Listen, LSTN, Listen headphones. And we used the proceeds to help provide hearing aids. And, you know, we started this with like a shoestring budget, terrible plan, had no idea that we were competing with Apple and Bose and Sony. It was like clearly like just ignorance that got us to start this company. Just wanting to give hearing aids. That was the goal. You know, we had been inspired by seeing someone here for the first time, said, we want to do that. And then headphones became the tool. So that grew and worked, and we got all these amazing partners, and we traveled to over 40 countries, and we were helping give, you know, tons of people hearing aids, you know, literally over 50,000 people we've given hearing aids. And what happened was, along the way, people were seeing all that and they were going, wow, you guys must be killing it. You must be super rich because they just, you know, Beats sold to Apple for $3 billion. And we were like, actually, this isn't that typical rags to riches story about making billions of dollars selling headphones. This is actually a different kind of rags to riches story, because while we surviving and doing okay, we're giving far more money to the charity than we were making, and we weren't getting rich, but we were getting rich in life experiences. Not only were we getting to see kids around the world hear for the first time, like literally hear people say, I love you, or hear the sound of rain or music for the first time, like these incredible moments, like that most people sadly will never get to experience, that kind of connective moment. And on top of that, we were traveling around the world and getting to see the entire world. Like we literally got to hike Machu Picchu and, you know, ride camels around the pyramids. And we got to, you know, go gorilla trekking in Rwanda and, you know, safaris in Kenya and just all of these incredible experiences to see the actual world. So when people would say, you guys must be rich, you must be killing it, we would just laugh and go, we're more like experiential billionaires. And that was kind of the, you know, deflection answer of no, we're not rich. We're actually, yeah, you know, we're awesome. Just barely getting by. But
yeah, that's I love that. It's a perfect answer. Hey, so one of the things that's really interesting about, I think, this conversation and about you and your background, you know, a lot of the things we've been talking about is just this concept of all these different life experiences and how they impact your life and this sense of that being an experience of a billionaire. But in your book, you talk about the fact that you've done one of the largest, I think it was like life experiences surveys potentially ever conducted. First off, what does that look like for our audience who may have never heard anything about this? And then given all the, you know, conversations you had there, or the data you collected, like what was the coolest and most surprising thing you learned from that huge survey effort?
Great question. This is like the information we got from this was just so incredibly valuable. I'll start with that, you know, the reason for this, you know, that study taking place was that moment, you know, once we kind of came to that realization that we were quote unquote experientially rich, but we weren't financially rich, but that was worth more to us than any number in a bank account. You know, that was like this aha moment where we're like, wow, like if we feel like that, what do other people feel like? You know, so we started asking friends and family and we started interviewing people in retirement homes. And then that led to us going even bigger and doing the study. And it's over 20,000 people. It's actually still running. And we asked questions like, what were the most valuable experiences in your life? What were your biggest regrets? What are the things that you most want to do, et cetera, like things like that. And it was really interesting because the most valuable things in people's lives, when we asked that question, everyone answered a life experience. Nobody put their car or their watch or their, yeah, you know, it was always some experience, like, you know, getting married in Hawaii or, you know, becoming a chef or doing something that like had some value. So people know that, yet that's just not how we act. Like we know that and we just work toward money as though money itself is going to solve all these problems and help us achieve these goals and stuff. But the thing that was really, really interesting that I hope that if anyone listening can take away, like, you know, one or two things from this whole conversation, it's that the number one things people said they still wanted to do or regret not doing in their lives wasn't climb Mount Everest or stay in overwater bungalows, or, you know, it wasn't like these huge bucket list, expensive, hard to do things. It was all achievable stuff. It was like 95% was like, actually, you know, I want to learn a musical instrument. I want to become fluent in a language. I want to become a better cook. I want to visit my family in the next state over. You know, like it was things that we can do. Those are the things that people have the most regret for or most yearning for. Yet we just don't take action. And again, that was the thing that was just really, you know, enlightening to know that everybody knows this, but they're just not doing anything about it. And that's why we wrote the book. The book was more tools for people to actually take action to try to solve for that. And the most surprising thing I would say on the whole list of experiences, and this goes toward, I think, the value of taking action, was that a full third of the answers people had for the most valuable experience in their life were negative experiences, or something that happened to them that changed them, that shaped them, that inspired them to push harder or try harder, which just shows you again that the progress of motion, of forward movement, is really the value. Even if things didn't work out, a lot of the time we gain a lot of value from those things. So it's more important to try and fail than to just stagnate. So that was a really interesting statistic that we found.
You know, I think this cognitive disconnect, if that's the right phrase for it, where, you know, there's these things that we, I want, I need, whatever it is, these things that we covet, whether it's, to your point, a, you know, crazy car or some, you know, high ticket item that they, everyone feels they need. And then to your point, people know that's actually not going to make them happy. And some people maybe even get those things, and maybe they have to get them to realize it's actually not what makes you happy. How do you try and steer people, you know, to kind of rewire their brain to, it's one thing to tell people to do it, but some people may just get paralyzed because their brain keeps playing tricks on them, if that makes sense, leading them down the wrong path.
Sure. And just again, so everybody understands, like, not only did I come to all of these conclusions and my business partner and, you know, live through all these experiences and then go on to, you know, conduct a study and write a book about it and create workshops and keynotes, I still have that same problem. Like, everyone has that problem. We really do have like this glitch in our matrix where if you're not paying attention, like, your brain will start to trick you into complacency and to stopping doing the things that matter or finding those things. But yeah, that's exactly what we do with in the book and in our talks and workshops. The first step for people to actually build experiential wealth is to understand what they value, right? So we have an exercise called your treasure map, where, you know, you can't actually get wealthy in experiences if you don't know what's valuable to you. And again, this is about finding urgency. It's fun. You know, we all know that people that had a near-death experience that come out the other side, like my dad, and change everything, you know, where they run that marathon or they propose to that girl or they just do that thing that they've always wanted to do because suddenly they realize that their time is finite and they got lucky this time and they don't want to take a chance again. So what we try to do is we try to give people that feeling of urgency minus the near-death experience. So that's the goal. But the way we do that, we actually do an exercise. This is like a cornerstone. Like,
our first step of our workshop is we electrocute people and bring them back from the dead. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, we bring them as close to death as possible. No, we go through an experiment where we say, okay, imagine your doctor just called and he's got bad news. It turns out you better sit down because you only have 1 year left to live. Now, write down 10 things that you absolutely must do that you know you will have just a mountain of regret over if you don't do these things in this next year. Those are things you have to accomplish to feel like your life was meaningful. And after people write that down, we tell them, okay, your doctor just called again. He's a terrible doctor, had the chart upside down. It actually turns out you only have 30 days to live. And you know, now you need to write down 5 things that you're going to do in the next month.
Genius. It's a prioritization exercise. Really smart.
Yeah. And the rule is, these things, don't think too much about what it costs, because if you only had a year or a month left to live, you'd probably figure out a way to pay for things. But they have to be things you could actually do in that time frame. You know, it has to be something that can be executed in that time frame. And then the last step is, okay, your doctor called again. He's going to lose his license now for sure, because it turns out you have 1 day to live. He just absolutely botched this. You got 24 hours to live. What are you going to do in the next 24 hours? What are 5 things you're going to do that you could actually do in 1 day that you would do? And you write those things down. Now, once everybody gets that done, we basically take a step back and say, okay, now look at these lists. Take the 1 year and the 30-day list and put an asterisk next to all of the things that you're actively working on at this time. And if you're like the vast majority of people in our workshops and our study that we speak to, it's one or none, which is wild that we have this like culture of busy and hustle in our lives that doesn't make any sense, because how can we be too busy to do something that is so important? It would be one of the only things that we insisted we do if we only had a year left or a month left to live, yet we're not working on them at all. We're not even taking steps toward working on them. So that's a big, you know, red flag for people to look at and say, okay, you know, how do I take this from my someday calendar that's never going to get done and start putting it onto my actual calendar so I can see I'm taking steps toward that. But that's a really fun, important first step, because you can't have urgency without intention, and you can't have intention without knowing what it is you're trying to do.
It's funny, you saying this really inspires me actually to share something personal that I've been working on recently. So I love this idea. It's like, what if it was a year? What if it was a month? And then what if it was only 30 days? And not to get mushy or anything, but if I only had one day, probably just want to spend the whole day with my wife, you know? And it's funny. And even if I was at 30 days, because your point is, it has to be things you can complete, probably just want to spend as much time as I could with my friends and family. You know, it's not necessarily even go someplace. And as someone who works entirely too much and openly admits it, you know, this was something that I've been working on. So my New Year's resolution this year, I was very inspired basically over my holiday break in December, took a couple of weeks off, and I found myself being really reflective about the fact that, frankly, you know, I don't travel like I used to. It was a time in my life I was doing, you know, 100, 130 flights a year, whether it was in New York or LA or London or Miami or, you know, Singapore, wherever it may be. There are friends that I'd made there. And when I traveled, they'd say, hey, I'm in town, let's have dinner. And then, you know, maybe there's industry events I was going to, whether it was CES or South by Southwest or the Cannes Lions or whatever. Maybe I only saw my friends there once a year. But it was enough that I'd kind of maintain those, you know, relationships. And so a lot of these kind of behaviors I used to do, that I used to maintain my friendships, I don't do anymore. And respectfully, not going to do anymore. You know, it just, so those behaviors kind of changed. I even moved from Miami to North Carolina. So I left a lot of my old friend circle there. And so the epiphany that I had was that these friendships are important to me. And that if I want to maintain these friendships, like, I have to make the energy to do it. It's something you have to carve out in your day, no matter how busy you are, even if you don't see these people. And so it took me about 2 days, but I went through my Facebook, my LinkedIn, my email, you know, everything I could think of. And I wrote down a list, and it was like maybe 100, 120 odd people. Some were old friends I felt like I'd fallen out of contact with. Some I hadn't spoken or really hung out with in 4 or 5 years. Some were people I actually had only met once or twice, but I thought were so interesting. And I just thought, why not build a friendship with these people? You know, who cares if I've only met them over video a couple of times? And I emailed all these people and was like, hey, I was like, I want to let you know that you left an impression on me. I just want to talk sometime. And I've got these people on the phone with no agenda. Said, they're like, so did you want to? I said, no, man, I just really liked meeting you a couple of years ago and I want to be friends with you. So I thought I'd reach out or I wanted to get to know you better, you know? And I've gotten the nicest possible reactions from people. And I'm really committed now to just every year, like clockwork, I'm going to, even if it's just once a year, you know, I just want to start reaching out to folks. One of the best New Year's resolutions I've ever had that I felt so good about. But it was so interesting. I didn't think about it until what you just said to me a minute ago, that actually this is very much in line with what I would do if I only had less time, you know, left in my life. It would be about building connections with people and maybe not about, you know, focusing on the new house I'm building, for example. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's very, very prescient. And I'll tell you that we actually do an exercise that is just that. And the reason for that is because in our survey, that was one of the top 5 answers people gave us for the things they regretted most at the end of their life. This was the people over 65, was not keeping in touch with my friends. That was literally one of the top regrets people have. And it's so avoidable. Like, it doesn't cost any money.
Oh, it's so easy to make excuses not to make the time. And, you know, I will openly admit I've been, you know, very inwardly focused, because I'm just, you know, I get caught up in all my own bullshit, frankly. You got to make the effort and it feels good. I can totally see why a lot of people are really inspired, you know, by what you're doing and why you'd want to go down this path. So on that note, I'd take a good kind of segue, I think, from that. I want to ask you, how does the kind of role of intentionality basically play in people going down this path of, you know, kind of living life to the fullest and having kind of a regret-free life?
Yeah, I mean, that's the key, right? You know, intentionality is the key. The number one excuses people have for not doing the things that they want to do are all the same. There's like, you know, the top three are, I don't have the time, I don't have the money, and I never got around to it. So it turns out we all have the same amount of time in the day. And of course, a lot of people are going to say, you know, well, I've got kids, or I've got to work a lot more than you, or et cetera, et cetera. It turns out you still have time. Everybody has time. how you use your time or let your time get taken from you is really a huge difference in whether or not you can, you know, fulfill a lot of your goals and dreams. So intentionality helps you reframe your relationship with time, because that is your most valuable resource. You know, time is everything.
So it's also the one resource that we all have equally.
That's right. Yeah, there's no reason that, you know, one CEO makes $8 million a year and someone else makes, you know, their time isn't that much more valuable. It's not. It's just situational. The crazy thing, though, is just how we use that same time. If you, for instance, like come home from work and you are tired and you have an opportunity to, you know, go and meet with a friend or, you know, do something that might be on your list of things to do, read a book, start a hobby, you know, learn a language, play an instrument, whatever this thing is that you could do, or it's much easier to sit down and just scroll Netflix, right? Or look at your phone and scroll or what. So those aren't really choices. People have to be less hard on themselves, because we live in a world that has all of these devices that were really incredibly, you know, they were designed perfectly for stealing our attention. That's what they do. But you have to realize that's what it's doing. Like, it's okay to watch a movie or watch a show, but plan it, be intentional. Say, tonight I'm going to watch a show from 7 to 8. That's my time. That's how I'm going to use it. But if you just sit and waste your time, like just looking for a way to waste your time for 2 hours, 3 hours, like a lot of people do every single day, that adds up to an entire lifetime of things. You know, you could literally become a concert pianist if you spent those same couple hours a night, you know, playing an instrument. And that's the kind of stuff that I think, you know, with intentionality, it just becomes a lot more clear how much more in control of our lives we are. And you can see this stuff take effect right away. Once you start to adopt this mindset, you start to put things down on paper, you start to share your goals and your dreams with your friends and family, even wider with your social networks, perhaps. And then people will start holding you accountable, whether you ask them to or not. You know, people will reach out, hey, did you write that book? Did you go on that trip? Did you do that thing? And then you can start to actually see, okay, these are the things that I should be doing because I've said I want to do it. I've got this intention to do it. And every time you do something and you get a little bit of a personal, you know, whether you get that interior cheer on from yourself or you get that exterior cheer from your friends that are like, hey, that's really cool. I saw you ran a 3K, 5K, 10K, whatever it is, that thing you said you were going to do, you went and did it. It inspired me to do that thing. And then next thing you know, you're building this community of like-mindedness and whatnot. So it's all about intention, though. Intention and urgency are the crux.
I love the positivity, and I hope it inspires a lot of the people that listen and watch O-Ship. I have to ask, it would not be O-Ship if I didn't ask for an O-Ship question. So for any of the audience that might be tuning in for the first time today, a big part of O-Ship is this premise that some people think that kind of, you know, these successful people that we have on the show running from point A to point B is that, and it's easy, and that, you know, everyone can be successful magically and look like a superstar like we all read about in, you know, all these different publications that some of us may consume. But the reality is, it's not that easy. The path from A to B is rarely A to B. It's normally A to Z to X to Y. And then if you're lucky, you make it to B. And then normally with some knocks along the way. And so one of the reasons this show exists is I want to inspire other entrepreneurs and leaders and just people who are trying to make it happen in this world, that it's okay to kind of land on your face. And it's about how you handle that. And sometimes the way that people handle it is very funny. Sometimes it can be very inspiring. Sometimes it can just be a journey of perseverance. But I'd love to hear, Joe, if you've got any kind of O-Ship stories maybe tucked away in your back pocket that you'd be willing to talk about that maybe, you know, is a great turnaround moment for you.
I think my life is primarily O-Ship stories. So, yeah, I'm pretty sure there's way more valleys than peaks if I look at it like that. Yeah, I'll share a couple of business and a personal one that I think we'll all, you know, kind of explain together. But from a business standpoint, you know, when we started the audio company, we were only about a year in and a bunch of people discovered it. We had just done our first hearing mission. And, you know, it was like, we were feeling like, wow, things are really, you know, people care. Like, we thought they did. The product was great. Everything was going well. And we got this opportunity to partner with a major corporation who I shan't name, but they came in and they said they were going to partner with us and they were going to fund one of our next charity missions and they were going to film and they were going to put it in Super Bowl ads and like literally do this crazy co-marketing campaign that was something that it would grow the company immensely and our mission would grow and it would have just been incredible. So, you know, we went really far down this road. Like we had like itinerary and flights and things to go do this mission and all these things. And so much so that we took a massive personal loan to finance a bunch of inventory that so we'd be ready for this huge growth moment that was going to come soon. And they literally ghosted us. They like all of a sudden just said everything's on hold and then they just kind of stopped getting back to us. And then, you know, literally the commercial to producing, you know, team, that you know, told us that everything was put on hold. Everything just kind of got put on hold. And we had all this inventory that we had bought that was coming in with no home for it. And it was like a really terrifying moment because we're like, oh my God, what do we do? What did we do and what do we do? And, you know, actually we just figured out a way to work through it. We just, you know, found homes for this product and worked really hard. And it allowed us to actually grow and it allowed us to do some things that we probably wouldn't have done. So we survived it, but there was definitely this.
Here's a great motivator.
Yeah, exactly. You know, there was this moment of like, okay, well, you know, like we may have just dug our own grave right now. It just shows you, you just don't know. Looking back, it was kind of a blessing because it allowed us to like, you know, do some stuff that we wouldn't have been able to do.
Yeah, it's funny. For a lot of entrepreneurs, no matter how confident anyone might be perceived out there, pushing beyond your comfort space is really hard for everyone. And sometimes that might be something that, you know, people just about how they share or express themselves. But in other ways, you know, it may be very tangible, like, hey, I'm not sure I'm ready to reach out to this customer to buy yet, or this new market is scary. But all of a sudden you get kind of served up these company life and death, you know, kind of situations. And you get motivated real fast. You start maybe, you know, pushing beyond your comfort zones out of necessity. And then the funny thing is, you survive those moments. You're like, I know how to do that now. And to your point, it makes you stronger. And I think that's a really great lesson for anyone who might be listening or watching the show right now. So thanks for sharing that, Joe. I really appreciate it. Look, I really enjoyed the chat today. You just got a really cool story and you're an inspiring guy. And I love how you look at the world. I have a sneaking suspicion a lot of our audience might be feeling the same way. If they want to, you know, buy your book, learn more about you, find out how to see you in a speak engagement or even book you for one, you know, what's the best way for people to find you?
You can just go to my website, which is joehuff.com, and that's got all the speaking information and workshop information. And then for the book and card decks, we also make card decks as well that are a quick and easy way for people to start having experiences every single day. It's full of exercises as well that are really easy, fun exercises to get started.
Is that based on the treasure map concept?
Yeah, we actually, that's the treasure map card deck. But there's the treasure map exercises in there along with a whole bunch of other stuff. So those are on Amazon, really cool.
I want to try that, actually. You inspired me.
Yeah, no, it's very great. Cool. I'll walk you through it and then I'll hold you accountable when you write your list down.
I like it. I think my wife would like this one as well. Yeah. So
experientialbillionaire.com and Amazon. You can find everything on Amazon as well under Experiential Billionaire.
I really appreciate it. And I appreciate you being on the show. A quick word to our guests and your audience today. Thank you again for subscribing and watching OShip. Whether you're watching the video show on YouTube, Facebook, LinkedIn, X, whatever streaming platform you're tuned into, or you're listening right now on any of the audio platforms that we stream on, thank you, thank you, thank you for listening to OShip. And we appreciate your support. It means the world to us. The best thing that you can do just to continue to support the show is give us a like, leave a comment, share it with your friends. And if you haven't clicked that subscribe button, click it now. If you want to learn more and about all the other places we broadcast, check out oshipshow.com. And again, thanks so much, Joe. It's just great to have you on today. And I look forward to meeting you in person one day and staying connected.
Thanks for having me, Freddie. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, my pleasure.